Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams, and today's show is brought to you by Savage Classical. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. Richard Sage is your guy over there. Savage Classical. It's got the best guitars on the East Coast, in my humble opinion. Is that right? Do I sound like a corporate stooge? Go to savageclassical.com. He's our longest running sponsor. He's been sponsoring me for at least 10 years. So support that. Today on the show, it's Jason Kerdobny. Jason Dobney's on the show, and I'm beyond excited about this one. He is the curator of the instrument collection at the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York City. He is an organologist. I think that's what it's called. When you study the instruments, and you know, it's unbelievable what we're about to learn from this man. I was humbled. This is a museum that I have a big relationship with personally. I used to live on the Upper East Side. I lived there for 9 years. You know, I started the show up there, and that would be almost a monthly activity. I would either go by myself, and just start my Sunday with a cup of coffee and just like pick an exhibit and go to one exhibit and walk out. That's the way you do it. You don't go there and just think, oh, I'm going to see as much as I possibly can see, because then you're going to be staring at spoons and Byzantine cups, and you're not going to see the Renoir. You're not going to see the Tiffany and some of the stuff that, you might enjoy. Or the blue bed. One time I got a little day drunk with my buddy, and he goes, there's this blue bed in the Met. Let's go see it. We stumbled into the Met, and there's a blue bed there. You can look for it. It's kind of an adventure. It's pretty deep in. Anyway, all that aside, I met Jason recently. He was very gracious. This is a very busy guy who has a lot of people to answer to, and a lot of people answering to him, and a lot of things going on. And he makes time for music in the community here in New York, if you can call, but it is the music community in New York. He goes cross genre. He was in my neighborhood seeing some jazz the other night, and then he was in another neighborhood. He's all over the city doing this. And we talk about that. And that's where I met him. I met him at a concert, not in my neighborhood, but in the city. And it's really great. It's really nice of him, to talk to us. Not just to me, but to also, engage with the guitar. And the Met Museum and the guitar have always had a great relationship, from Segovia to the fact that the GFA Gala was just there a month ago. And this is all in preparation for the Guitar Foundation of America that is coming to New York. And that's, that's a very rare and important event for the GFA to take place in New York. The GFA takes place every year. But while you're here, because I know a lot of you listening are maybe going to come, right? You're fans of classical guitar. You listen to this show. The show's in New York. You're going to come. You're probably excited to be here. You're thinking about all the things you can do. You can go see The Lion King. Or you can go check out this exhibit. There are outstanding guitars, and it's, we'll talk about it when I talk to Jason, but there's a lot of reasons that you should visit here. Mainly Segovia's, namely Segovia's guitar is there. So if you're thinking about making that pilgrimage, do it. All right. It's something he talks about. It's something that used to happen more often than it does now. So we're trying to drive you guys over there. Okay. And just like when you visit Savage Classical, tell them I sent you. Now I'm actually, this is terrible, but I'm going to be out of town. Right? Isn't that my big complaint years and years ago when I started this, was that these guitar competitions, they require you to get a hotel, to fly there, and then to pay a big fee and that's not fair, and blah, blah, blah. Well, now they're here. They are a train ride away. And for $2.75, I could get there. I'm not sure what their fee is, but, you know, it's doable. I probably could have, you know, gotten in there with the show or whatever, but it's not going to happen. I'm going to camp. You know, I go to camp. That's what I do. That's what I do for a living, is educate and work with kids. I hey, you guys had your chance with me. But I'm doing this, and that's important to me, and it's important to the camp that I work at and all my friends in that world that I'm there. I'm going to be just consulting because baby Wally's coming. So with baby coming, I got to get in and get out. So I'll be there for like a week and a half, training their staff, building out their recording studio, doing all that, doing live sound, getting all their software ready so that they can teach effectively. It's really exciting. I'm really excited about it. Basically, we'll talk about this some other time because we got a lot to cover. But I won't be here. But you, while you're here, need to go to the musical instrument, you know, area, which is right above the armory in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City when you're here. You know, if you get kind of tired of seeing who can play a scale the fastest. Sorry. I'm sorry, GFA. You know, I love you. We're all friends, right? It's okay for me to poke a little bit of fun. Also, you know, GFA has a billion incredible concerts. A lot of my friends are going to be playing there. Super, super important that you go if you can. If you are competing in the GFA, God bless you. Good luck. Godspeed. Get to the Met. All right. Today we've got a guest at the beginning of the show. We've got Nick Hurt. Nicholas Hurt is from Austin, Texas. And I know you guys are thinking, oh, Brett, you know, you went to school in Austin. It's not my fault. It's Matt Hensley's fault. You know, it's Joe Williams' fault that that place has become such a big deal. I had nothing to do. I left. I got out. I left. It's not my fault that it's such a big deal, but it is. In the United States, it's the center of the classical guitar universe, I think. And that's, is it fair? Is it right? I don't know. That's not my business to talk about, but I love Matt. And I think he's doing everything I would want someone to do. He's doing stuff I'm incapable of doing from a temperament standpoint. But let's talk about Nicholas Hurt. Nicholas Hurt is a guitarist and teacher from Austin, and he made a short performance film documentary called Serenade, I Miss You, that is going to be premiered, or I think it already premiered, the Austin Classical Guitar Society, The Rosette. It premiered in April. But he wants you guys to know about it, and there's a good reason for that, and we're going to talk about it. But basically, I just watched it. I watched it this morning. It's outstanding, like anything else that the Rosette is doing in Austin. The Rosette is their performance space. It's a performance space owned and operated by the Classical Guitar Society. How about that? But Nick, along with, it seems like a billion people down there, are not just playing pieces. They're not just playing scales. They're actually out there composing and doing the work that they have to do to become artists that transcend the instrument. And let you know, that's sort of what's going on here. He profiles like five composers, basically interviews them, and then plays their music. And they're interesting young people. Everybody in this is interesting. Everybody's young. Everybody is going for it, right? They're putting their heart into this. So make sure you check that out. It's on YouTube. And I'm going to talk to Nick right now.
Just speaking for myself, I have just thought a lot about what would be interesting for an audience and how much I can really bring to this beautiful scene that is maybe a little newer. And also just looking at myself as a player, like, do I need to add my voice to these pieces that have been played so well by so many people?
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be sort of a reprieve for a lot of people, is that these things have already been played so well.
Sure.
And, you know, David Russell did a great job. What can I do? Who can I play? What you have done with Serenade, I Miss You, which premiered at the Rosette in April, it's a film. It's really a film. It's a beautiful film that I watched on my TV with my I got a pretty good speaker system, and so I really kind of like committed to it, and I just sat and had coffee yesterday because yesterday was my first Monday off.
Nice.
In between summer camp and the school that I teach at. And it's just such a wonderful morning. I just had toast and coffee and watched you. I mean, you clearly were interviewing them, but there are four composers, and it's shot beautifully. It looks like you're using Barton Springs. It looks like you're using different parts of the Green Belt, all these beautiful parts of Austin, which if you don't know Austin, if you're from Europe or if you just haven't been there, you may be thinking it's going to be, you know, the Wild West. You think it's
right, cowboys and six shooters.
It is literally one of the most sort of jungly, beautiful places that I've ever been. Some parts of Austin, but mostly the hill country and sort of the parks and stuff there. They're just beautifully maintained, instant access to nature. And I'm sure that's continuously under threat, but you were able to really capture the beauty of Austin. You were able to capture the creativity of it. You started out with your most eccentric composer.
Yeah, Zeke
Which
German.
Really just, I mean, it's just, yeah, he's got the hair out to here, and he's just sort of free-form thinking. And the whole thing, I was like, oh, we are in Austin, Texas. This is a Keep Austin Weird situation. It was so sort of, you really were tuned into into what makes that city great, and then connecting our instrument to it. It was very beautiful. I mean, it was really, really good. And I can't believe everybody, I'm really lucky to have everybody who's ever worked or supported the show or advertised on the show. There was a time when I was selling mattresses, but that's all over now. And now I'm able to, I kind of keep it to things that I really like or to people that come from environments that I trust. And, tell me more about this. Tell me more about sort of the genesis of this and the composers that you are going to be profiling.
Yeah. Well, first off, just like, thank you so much, Brett. I'm so glad to hear that you had that experience watching it. I mean, just that means the world to me coming from you. And I you know, in some ways, it's kind of funny. We started talking about San Diego at the very beginning here. You know, in some ways, this was a project of me missing my hometown of Austin and missing the musicians and missing the environment and commissioning pieces from all Austin musicians so I could kind of stay connected in some ways to the scene and to the community and in some ways to the place as well. So yeah, I commissioned pieces from Justice Phillips, Claire Puckett, and Zeke Jarman, all really wonderful guitarists and really wonderful musicians, not all necessarily classical in the very strict sense of that, you know, genre. And then I wrote a piece for the film
as
did. Well.
And it was gorgeous. Spring.
Ah, oh, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, it was all about Barton Springs, that one. So
That's why it was called Spring.
Yeah.
Was it called Spring? Am I right?
Yeah, it was The Springs.
The Springs. Oh, it was about Barton Springs. Okay, there you go.
And yeah, so I commissioned these pieces, and the process of working with the composers, talking with them, it's the first time I've ever done anything like that, learning about what it meant to them, the music means to them. Learning about their process and just sort of their philosophy and their personality, it seemed like it wasn't going to be enough for me just to learn this music and record it and film it, even if it looks beautiful. I wanted to make something more, and so I decided to bring in their voices and bring in sort of their personality and their humor. And that's really what made it the film, Serenade, I Miss You, instead of just like a collection of me playing newly commissioned pieces, which would have been fun, but it was, I think it really became, without me knowing it, it became something more.
All right, we're listening to a snippet of Lantern by Claire Puckett, as performed by our friend Nicholas Hurt. Thank you, Nicholas, for supporting the show. Make sure that you see him perform this piece on Serenade I Miss You, available on YouTube right now. That's Serenade I Miss You by Nick Hurt. Let's get on with the show. This is my time with Jason Kerr Dobney at the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York City.
You don't just go to classical. I mean, last night you were at the Cutting Room, it looked like.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
I mean, you're at a show every single night, like a major show.
Well, try. I feel like that's part of my job, to get out and to meet musicians and to hear good stuff.
But it's amazing that you do that, that you go all over the place. And, you know, most of us just have to go to our friends' salon concerts. But you get to do everything.
I try. I really try.
What'd you see at the Cutting Room last?
The Gretsch Drum and Guitar Company celebrated its 140th anniversary this year. And they had a massive program with a bunch of great drummers, a lot of free jazz, and showed a new documentary about the company history. So that was happening at the Cutting Room on Tuesday night.
Yeah, but you genuinely love this stuff. I mean, it's your job, but you also, I mean, I don't know, sometimes these jobs can sort of get into the hands of people that maybe don't necessarily, they're like, okay, that's my job, and then after work I'm gonna, and I'm guilty of that. Like, I'm guilty of sort of being like, oh, I'm gonna play a board game, I'm not going to a concert.
No, I get that, but I think this is where COVID really taught me a lot about who I am. Mm-hmm. I've been a musician since I was a little kid, and I think I used to have that mindset, and then COVID comes along, and there's like no live music forever.
Wow.
And I remember the first time I walked by I guess it was like a cabaret bar in New York City where they were like singing on the street, like show tunes, and I started crying. Like, it was the first time I heard live music like 18 months or something. And I think, so coming back into the real world at post-COVID in New York, I was like, I'm just jumping in the music scene. I'm going to do this. I'm going to make myself do this. And it's thrilling, and it's what I love to do.
So before COVID, it was a little more like maybe once or twice a week, or maybe, you know, two times a month, like a normal person.
You got it. Yes.
Well, I'm jealous of you too, because that doesn't come free. That's a lot of research too that you have to do to kind of figure out where to go and what's going on. But the Gretsch Guitar Company, did they contact you? Do a lot of people sort of contact you with this stuff?
I do. Yeah. I mean, in this world, a lot of people tell me, I've got my, you know, friends now, the favorites. It's and something like that. Like, that was definitely the Gretsch Company reaching out and saying, hey, we're having this big party, and that's why I got to sort of be a part of that.
And you and I were at Imani Winds.
Love them.
I mean, that's just, yeah. If I was telling the listeners on the last show that, you know, they really should just go check this stuff out, because it is genre-bending. I mean, it just sort of just like, it makes you feel like you're at an everything show, not just at a classical music show, even though the skill and the language that they're using is definitely like high art.
Oh, but that's the Imani Winds. I mean, we have there's like a preconception of what a wind quintet is.
Yeah.
And they ain't it. You know, it's like they just do everything. And my role here is, I think, about musical instruments. And yes, they're art. We're at the Met. Musical instruments are great works of art. They're great works of craft. But they are tools first. Mm-hmm. And I think guitarists, probably more than other instrumentalists, would understand that a guitar can be used for any type of music and any type of genre. I went to Mexico last year and, you know, went to all of these places where in the U.S. you'd hear steel string guitars. And in Mexico, everything was a nylon string guitar.
Yeah.
And it was a totally different sound. But they're doing Beatles with nylon string guitars at like resorts in Mexico. And it was like, yeah, because it's a tool and a musician's going to use it to make music. And I think we sometimes get in our little lanes about, I do this thing and that's the thing I do and that's all I do. And I think that's not a healthy attitude.
Yeah.
You know, we often say, sorry, I'm on a soapbox.
No, actually, this is good, because this is the thing, is identifying too much with sort of the grandeur of your instrument, and not just sort of transcending the instrument is a term that we used, you know, in performance school a lot.
I love
and how
that.
Important that was.
And that's, but we say this thing all the time, that music, art, it's like an international language.
Yeah.
It's a truly whatever. But you go to a concert of one type of music and you see that type of person. And then you go to a classical guitar concert one night, and then you go to an Indian sitar concert the next night. You don't see any of those people crossing over. And how is it actually going to be this language that is between us as humans if we're not going to the other musics that we don't normally know?
Yeah.
So that's something I've also come to realize. Like, if we really want it to be this thing that transcends language and barriers and stuff, then we have to go to stuff that transcends our own barriers.
And so, I mean, you obviously this is going to translate into the work that you're doing here at the Met. Is, you know, when I first moved here in 2002, there was an instrument collection. It was mostly European. It was mostly, you know, it was all classical instruments to an extent. I don't want to say just not prehistoric, but definitely some older things or some things from more indigenous populations and stuff like that. And so what are you doing at the Met these days to sort of, it seems like you're branching out, you know, it seems like you're getting, you said that you got Peter, Paul, and Mary's guitar, for example. I mean, we just said that in passing. Yeah. That isn't something that you sent me, but I remember that. And that kind of struck me. I was like, oh, that's cool. See, that wouldn't have been there in 2002. Those guitars wouldn't have been, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there was like, was there the Sgt. Pepper's jacket or something down there?
No, that's a great memory. That was, there was a rock fashion show in the 90s.
Right. Oh,
and they had Sgt. Pepper, and they had some instruments here at that time. You're remembering what was our old gallery setup.
Mm-hmm.
And that was installed in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And it was here for almost 50 years, 45 years.
Yeah.
And it was organized sort of, one room was all Western instruments. And you know, one display case was like the history of the clarinet, and then the history of the oboe, and then the history of the guitar. And then the other side, we had two long galleries, was sort of instruments of the rest of the world. And this is a very old-fashioned sort of view of things. Even things like the history of an instrument, like you can go to Wikipedia and learn the history of an instrument, you know, quicker and probably better than trying to look at the examples that we have at the Met, because there's always going to be a hole. You can't collect everything. And that also doesn't speak to most people that aren't musicians of that, you know, instrument type.
Right.
There's also this sort of like old view of the West and the rest, and like somehow European art is different than, which isn't true, and it's kind of an old hierarchy. And so we decided, when we were finally able to redo our galleries in the mid 2010s, we wanted to break that down. So now if you walk through our galleries, we've got things from China next to things from Europe, you know, things from Africa next to things from South America, and trying to make the connection, go back to this idea that really music is this sort of thing that's innate to all of us, and that it is a language and a thing that transcends stuff, and that these ideas travel. You know, as a guitar player, there are so many instruments around the world that are played in similar ways, and that's kind of cool. And guess what? Those ideas actually traveled along things like the Silk Route or over the Middle Passage, and they become these tools that different types of people use. And that stuff's just kind of really cool when you can put these instruments together and tell those stories. And that's what we're trying to do. And I've got several colleagues, and we sort of reimagine the whole space when we reinstalled in 2017-18.
And that was the big 2-year renovation.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've been back since then. I don't think so. I think some stuff happened.
I'm going to give you my whole thing.
Yeah, here. Give me the whole thing.
We call our collection Art That Makes Art. You know, they are works of art, but they make art. That's the tool part of it. It's about who made it, but it's also about who played it and why.
Yeah.
And so what we do that's a little bit different, and it's sort of different from the museum, we're sort of a crossroads. So there's two cases that sit next to each other at the beginning of our galleries. One of them is a 16th century violin made by Andrea Amati, the man that sort of perfected the modern violin, the way it would look ever since, and we all know what that looks like. It's painted with the coat of arms of Philip II of Spain and symbols of the French court, because he married Elizabeth of Valois. And then on the ribs, there's a Latin motto that says, by religion, this bulwark will stand. And it's about the Counter-Reformation. It's about the Catholic houses of Spain and France marrying to fight the Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
It sits right next to a pipa from China, made about the same time, 16th century. There's 110 ivory plaques on this pipa. Every single one of them is carved with the symbols of Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and they are laid out in these honeycomb pattern that's an Islamic motif. Mm-hmm. It's about this Chinese empire that had religious pluralism. So these two objects from very different parts of the world,
right,
both made 500 years ago, both exquisite works of art, are expressing these ideas about humanity and about religion and about philosophy. The European one saying, hate the other, and the Chinese one saying, we can all live peacefully together.
Oh, how crazy.
Those are the stories we
That's Ming Dynasty is what you said. That's right. And that is that what that dynasty is known for a little bit, is pluralism?
Well, I don't
and
know
other
that
things. It's 300 years. So.
It's an empire. Right. They're all evil in some way. But those are the sorts of stories that we're trying to unpack.
Wow.
What are these objects trying to say to us? What are they? Why were they made? Who were they used? What do they represent?
Yeah.
Not just, again, we get a little too much in our own 20th century, neuroses about playing techniques and playing whatever. And they're so wonderful, but we forget these bigger ideas.
And so some of those, so we're talking about political and cultural ideas that are of the time that are being reflected in the construction of these instruments.
Right.
Wow.
And why.
And
like,
why.
And sometimes, like that whole thing.
Right.
Why? I mean, why are they
why put that on a pipa?
I think that's an unanswerable question, but I do think it speaks to the role that music plays in human life and society.
Yeah.
And we just forget that because we turn a radio on in the car whenever we jump in.
Yeah, and we're like, I like that.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to listen to that now.
There you go.
Well, that's what that's sort of like the new direction that you've gone in since the renovation in 2017 and 18. Before the collection was, what's his name? Andre Mertens? Is that the name of the gallery?
The name of the gallery, Andre Mertens.
Yeah. Was he a donor?
Like, he was a donor.
Was he Guggenheim or was he like a,
no, I mean, he was a,
was he a real, he was he an artist?
He was a Viennese sort of, I think he was Jewish that escaped before World War II, came to America, sort of made money. I think he had already died, and his wife gave the money in his honor to name the galleries. You know, music lover, music aficionado, but I think it was one of those, made it good in America and wanted to give back.
And it's pretty outstanding that, the Met would, even back then, because this was, when was that?
That was 1970.
So, yeah, well, that's pretty late. So that's how long it took for us to get a musical instrument museum. Do you know anything
about
I mean, or at least in the Met,
Well, that was the first permanent galleries, but the Met.
The Met's had
a collection since 1885. 40 some musical instruments came in. And then in 1889, a woman, is actually the great story, it's the only sort of foundational collection given by a woman. She donated 270 musical instruments from all over the world and this catalog that she put together. And she gave it to the museum with the one stipulation in the contract was that she could add to the collection, pieces as she saw fit.
Oh.
Over the next 30 years, she collected 3,600 instruments for the museum. And that is the core of our collection.
And I mean, what was her, did she just go around and just, oh, that's cool. Can I get that from you?
No, she actually approached it. So she was,
what was her name again?
Mary Elizabeth Brown. She was the daughter of a missionary, sort of Episcopalian, or I think Presbyterian.
Right. Oh, that would
minister.
Do it. Yeah.
And then her husband was the chairman of Brown Brothers Bank. And so through these two, this is 19th century. So through these two sort of connections, the church and then this business world, she had connections all over the globe, and she activated them. And of course, this is the days of like letters and put it in the mail and
right.
Who the hell knows if it will get anywhere. And she managed to build like an entire network globally of people that were looking for rare, unusual, beautiful instruments for her. And I always like to remember when I tell that story, this is the late 19th century, early 20th century. This is before recorded music. So in some ways, she was trying to collect the physical objects
right.
that represented the world's music.
Right.
We sort of lose that now when you can go to YouTube and hear anything anytime. That wasn't possible then. And I think it was through these objects that she could tell that story.
I mean, yeah, it takes on a completely different meaning without any real anticipation of the way that we would be able to listen to things
exactly.
in the future.
Exactly. Now, the irony of it to me is she's out there collecting and she knows that in many parts of the world, this music is disappearing. But of course, she's connected to the church and to the capitalist business, which are the forces that are sort of causing these musical genres to fail. It's the colonialism aspect of it. But so it's ironic that she's a part of it. And yet she could see that it was causing the music to disappear.
Wow. Yeah. And but she was trying to preserve these instruments while there was also colonization going
right
on.
To preserve this musical culture that was disappearing because of
it's amazing. It's well, that's the sort of the thing about that Victorian era, you know, adventure time sort of situation where they would go on these grand tours.
Yeah.
And but
and I think that's how it started. Yeah. And then I think she wrote later on that she realized that she was collecting things from musics that were dying.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like rich people moving into like a, you know, an artsy neighborhood and then yeah. No more artists.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But way worse.
Way worse.
So as far as that's, you know, that's the history of the renovation. Let's talk about your relationship with the guitar in particular. You the GFA gave a gala at the Met about a month ago now. And you were part of that, and the GFA is going to be the Guitar Foundation of America is going to be hosting their annual competition in New York City, competition and festival, at the Manhattan School of Music on 125th Street area, and you wanted to come on because this is a collection that is often overlooked by people that visit the city, by guitarists that visit the city. Like you were saying, part of this is sort of a pilgrimage, and for us seeing, you know, Segovia's Ramirez that he used on so many of the recordings, you know, that was gifted to him so that he could spread not only that but that style of guitar throughout the world, and how important that is to us, and to be able to come and see that. And learn more about those stories is something that these people that are coming to celebrate the guitar might be interested in, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I really hope that every classical guitarist that comes to the city for the Guitar Foundation of America comes to the Met, because we really have this long relationship with the community of classical guitarists.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you mentioned the Segovia. I mean, that's probably where most. I mean, it's one of our most famous objects. His, we have both of his guitars. We have a 1912 Ramirez guitar, mm-hmm. and then we have the 1937 Hauser guitar, which is the guitar that probably it put classical music in all of our ears.
Yeah,
it's
that's true. Yeah, of course, it's the Hauser that. Yeah.
So that's the sound that
recordings of the 50s and stuff. Yeah.
Exactly, the sound that we all think of when we think of Segovia and the classical guitar, and in some ways, just the
it's
instrument
right there,
in general.
Yeah.
And it is such a pilgrimage point, and of course, it's such a great story about those instruments and how they relate to each other, and. But that's just a starting point. So
I'd love to talk about that.
So he gave the instruments in 1986. But what I didn't really truly know before I got here mm-hmm. was that he had a little bit longer of a relationship. He had given one of his famous master classes at the museum in 1982. I think at the time it was the only East Coast master class he'd given in decades.
That's true.
Or something.
Yeah.
And of course, those were such famous events, it seems, from the history books. And that had happened here. And then apparently he had said that, you know, New York was so important to his career, and that he'd made his New York debut at the Town Hall. I don't remember. It was in the 20s, I think. And that had really set his career on fire. And so he had sort of really pinpointed New York. And so he knew he wanted his guitars to be here. And so we got the 1912 Ramirez, mm-hmm. which, of course, there's that famous story about how he went to the Ramirez shop and was looking for a guitar and really couldn't afford one. And they had had this guitar that had been an 11-string guitar. And then I think it was Santos Hernandez who had transitioned it, changed it to mm-hmm. be a 6-string guitar. And he played it, loved it, and that's how he got this Ramirez. And then he used that for, you know, 20 years or so.
So it was an 11-string instrument.
Right. Spanish.
I don't even know if that's a... I don't know if that's a thing. Is that a thing, people? I don't know if 11 string. I know the 8, but I don't know about 11.
That was a thing at the time.
And then they just took the strings off and he played it?
Well, no. I mean, it had been transformed.
So yeah, completely.
Before he got there. Huh. But, you know, in Mexico, there's the Guitarra Septima, it's called, and that has 11 strings. So it's not completely unusual, and it was a instrument in Spain at the time. Mm-hmm. And he took that instrument, played all over the world, became famous. Mm-hmm. And then there's this sort of really amazing story about how he meets a young German maker, Hermann Hauser. And the story goes that Hauser showed him an instrument and he recognized this is a talented young luthier. And then Hauser says, can I borrow your Ramirez, I want to learn the Spanish style. And I, whatever happened, he was allowed access to it. Like, I don't know, he, you know, just had it while Segovia was there or borrowed it overnight. Apparently measured everything, drew everything, looked at the whole instrument.
Right.
Goes away, builds a guitar based on that model. Finds Segovia next time he's somewhere and brings the guitar to him. Segovia plays it, goes, wow, this is really good, but you know, you should try X or Y or whatever. And this starts a relationship that goes on for something like a dozen years or 13 years where Hauser's building instruments, taking them to Segovia. Segovia's giving his feedback, change this, do this, try this. And then in 1937, Hauser shows up, gives him this guitar. Segovia says, this is the guitar I want to play the rest of my life. And he takes that guitar, and then everything that we know after that happens, all the great recordings, all of the sound of Segovia. I think he plays it for 25 years or so. And so it's that sort of golden period of Segovia's recordings all on that instrument.
Wow.
And then the strange thing, of course, he gives it to the Met in...
That is strange because, you know, I mean, he's an internet... I never even considered that when I was looking at him before. I was like, oh, yeah, they're in the Met. Met's the big museum. Well, Met's a big museum here.
Yeah.
There's other big museums.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know that, Jason.
Yeah, well, I've heard of a few.
But this, I mean, this, they must have these similar collections with Stradivarian. Yeah, totally.
But wow. Segovia wanted it to be in New York.
Why?
Because of the town hall show and because this is where he had
maybe made Augustine, his
international fame.
You know,
and then, of course,
the
Augustine.
You're right, yeah.
Because they were close. And yeah, so anyway, so that... That's why they came here. Now, the strange thing about him, as opposed to many other donors, is that he put a clause in the gift that no one could ever play the instruments again.
Of course he did.
which is a little unusual. You know, most of we have
you'd be like, I want this to be played. Yeah.
So it seems a little bit, I mean, I suppose it was ego. I suppose it was a lot of different things. Yeah. Now, looking at it from our perspective, what, 40 years after that.
Very happy.
Those strings on those guitars... are the last strings Segovia played on them.
Yeah.
That's pretty
cool. That is
so
cool.
So maybe it was egotistical at the time, but now it feels like a real...
Well, because eventually, you know, whoever played that guitar, it would have been like a political situation. It would have been like, I'll donate the money if I'm allowed to play his guitar. Like
we
that.
Aren't quite that crass here, but thanks.
But I just, what I mean is, I mean, like, you know, who knows who would have ended up playing it. But it probably would have been Parkening, Isbin, and all these other people, which is
sure, which
great.
Would have been amazing. I mean, can you imagine that?
But at the same time, I do like the fact that he, by virtue of doing that, it's sort of just it's like, okay, everybody hands off. Nobody gets it. You guys are going to fight over it? Nobody gets it.
Yeah, in a way that also, because that also would happen if he'd sold, let's say he'd sold them.
Yeah.
You know, they probably would have ended up in some like, you know, like bank vault in Saudi Arabia or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it's really good that they're here because then we all get to look at them, which is sort of the museum. That's the Indiana Jones thing. It belongs in a museum.
And the thing about, you know, what's really cool about, I mean, again, we're a little bit now, I mean, removed from Segovia.
Yeah.
But these stories sort of are handed down within the museum about how emotional people get about these objects. Mm-hmm. So there were times when there were like, it was a pilgrimage and people would stand in front of the Segovia and cry because it was such important to them. It was so important to their sound about why they played classical guitar, about why they did this thing. And we see less of that now, but it still is a pilgrimage for a lot of classical guitarists.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine that you would see less of it now. We've gotten, you know, so far removed from sort of the great man theory
exactly.
of history and of everything. It's just sort of like this younger generation is on this endless quest to demystify.
Well, that's yes, but I think it's even different. I think it's we just don't have the personal connection to him because we weren't there, and I think that actually might have more to do with it. I think you're right. The great man theory and all that stuff is debunked this.
Did you ever, what do you play? What's your musical background?
Yeah, I'm a trained pianist.
Where did you go to school?
So I'm from the Midwest. I grew up in Iowa and then I went to the University of South Dakota. Got my piano degree and an education degree there. And they have the world's largest collection of musical instruments on the campus of the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. And I fell in love with musical instruments as these objects, as tools, as cultural indicators, as societal, you know, objects with all of this meaning to them. And it kind of, it changed my life. You know, I sort of took a left turn and said, yeah, I don't want to practice. I want to
I want to
look at instruments.
Yeah. Yeah. Look at them. And so, I mean, it's right. That's when you made the turn into this sort of,
yeah.
Would that be a history? Then you go towards history, or what is this curation, music?
Well, yeah. Like, so it's,
how did you get here? 'Cause this is an incredible, job.
Well,
it seems very hard and very involved and very much like you're working, you must work all the time. But, you know, like this office feels like in the movies, like you would think. There's books everywhere, and there's a collection of mandolins on the wall that you said were part of a mandolin orchestra, which used to be like a way that they would market the sales of their matching mandolins.
Well, mandolins orchestra were...
Quartet.
Mandolin orchestras were a big deal at the turn of the century. And every little town, every... factory floor, they would have groups of mandolinists, and they would get together after work and they would play. It was just a huge, huge social thing more than anything. Mandolin clubs, they were called. And Gibson was marketing to them, and they built this whole set of match things. So yeah, but you know, what's that old saying about do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life?
Yeah.
I feel like that's my story. I just fell in love with what I do. I'm a musician first and foremost. I told you, going to these music events is like feeds my soul.
Yeah.
And I just love what I do. But with all things in life, it's never a straight line. So I had gone to school to be a musician. I wanted to get out of the Midwest and go somewhere big, but I, you know, went to a state school close by to save money.
Yeah.
Fell in love with this thing, but then, you know, ended up teaching, you know, middle school music for a couple of years. And
wow. There you go.
Went to a little museum in Iowa, the Music Man Square, the Meredith Willson Museum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy that wrote The Music Man, like 76 trombones hanging on the ceiling. Like, that was my first museum gig. And, you know, just sort of paid my dues and sort of worked my way up and then landed at the Met. So it's been a fun but unusual ride. But the field, it's sort of a little bit controversial. It's called the field of organology, mm-hmm. which is also a field of internal medicine. So that's why it's a little controversial.
Yeah.
Are you a musical instrument nerd, or do you do internal medicine? But,
but organology is what it's actually called. That's a technical term
for organology. The degree I got was called, it was a master's degree in the history of musical instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at the University of South Dakota, the only place in the country you could do that.
Wow.
And I think the only place you can do it still. And that's sort of how I got into this. The stuff.
So, I mean, as far as, you know, your musical background, the piano, all that stuff, what are your favorite parts of the collection, other than, you know, you do have more guitar, we should talk a little bit more about that, but what's your favorite thing in the collection?
My God. We have so much cool stuff. And
I know you got the gold gold harpsichord.
Yeah, that's...
You've got the oldest piano.
Yeah, and that's probably the
most... In the world.
Oldest piano in the world.
That's got to be the coolest thing.
So all the people listening to this should come here and drool over the Segovia guitar and then go look at the oldest piano.
The oldest piano in the world.
Yep.
Wow.
It was made in 1720 in Florence by a man named Bartolomeo Cristofori, who was the instrument keeper for the Medici family. So basically he was the musical instrument curator like me for the Medici court. He took care of a set of Strad instruments. He took care of, you know, like recorders and all sorts of.
So you get this guy. You're feeling his vibe.
You got it.
And you're talking 1720. And the Medici court is the first piano.
Yeah, because he was, so a little bit earlier than that, he was trying to, well, think about music, classical music at the time, right? You got opera's big.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got this guy making violins down the road in Cremona named Stradivari.
Mm-hmm.
And what do violins and the human voice both do really, really well?
Vibrato.
Well, they do vibrato.
Sustain.
It's the expressivity of dynamics.
Why did I even try?
Well, you can do all of that, but
I'm a failure.
For my story, it's about the volume. Because a harpsichord can't do that, right? Mm-hmm. Harpsichord, you know, you can't.
No dynamic variance.
Right. So his whole thing was like, I got to have an instrument I can use with the human voice, an instrument I can use with the violin. And so he tries to invent an improved harpsichord that can play with, you know, each finger stroke can be a different velocity and therefore give you some dynamic range. And he invents this hammer mechanism for the harpsichord. So it's one of those stories about like he was trying to improve this thing, and in the course of that he invented something else.
Yeah.
Which is it's the oldest piano that exists.
But he was trying, so what he was doing is what he set out to do, make a piano forte, make something you could play loudly or quietly.
Yep, you got it. It was a gravicembalo col piano e forte.
Wow.
Keyboard that could play soft and loud. And of course we all know those musicians. piano means soft, and that's where the instrument got its name.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's music at the Met, and yeah. that's been a huge part of what you've done.
Of course.
And what I'm pretty sure it's a lot of it's been done on your tenure, right?
Well, I mean, I've been here for 15 years, and so I've been a part of seeing things change. Part yeah. of it is the world changing. I mean, we've got great staff, and my predecessor was fantastic, and he's the one that led us through the renovation period, and mm-hmm. then I took over as the chair of the department. I've been going a lot more towards pop culture. You know, I've been looking at, you know, right. I mean, nowadays, what's the difference between rock and roll and classical? Like, yeah, there are some gray hairs that still think there are, but those barriers are coming down.
Yeah, they are.
You know, there's high and low art is no longer a thing. You know, it's like there's art. And so we've been looking a lot more at 20th century things, a lot more at pop culture. I did a big exhibition on rock and roll musical instruments in 2019 called Play It Loud.
Yeah.
And looking forward to telling more stories. You know, I mean, I want to get an electric guitar collection in. I want to get some electronica stuff going on. You know, I want to start thinking more like a modern musician. What are the tools that modern musicians are using?
This is amazing. I've got an idea. My idea is that we...
The answer is no.
Is that you let me learn the violin real quick in front. No, what we're going to do is we're going to, if it's cool with you, I'd like to go ahead and take a little tour now, and then we come back and we finish up.
Sure.
Does that sound like a good idea?
Sounds fine to me.
Sort of like a little break, and then, you know, I'll record it on my iPhone. There's no guarantee whether or not it'll sound good, but at least we'll, you know.
Yep.
I got a vibe. I can be like, oh, I'm holding the iPhone in the right place.
There you go.
And we'll see how it sounds.
We'll see. If nothing else, you'll
have
more stories.
And then we'll come back and we'll talk some more. We'll Great. Come back to this wonderful Indiana Jones like office. We're again with Jason, and we're looking at the two guitars of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Is that right?
That's right. So it's a steel string Martin guitar that Peter Yarrow played, and a nylon string Martin guitar that Noel Paul Stuckey played on the first album of Peter, Paul, Mary's, their eponymous self-titled album. So all their songs on the album are on these two guitars. I don't know if people know that sound of like the nylon string and the steel string guitar playing on top of each other. It's a beautiful thing that matches well with their voices. And it's, they're very simple pieces. I mean, they're tools, but yeah. this group is so iconic in American, you know, sort of music, but also American history. So they recorded If I Had a Hammer on this, which they won two Grammys for, on these two guitars.
Yeah.
But things like Where Have All the Flowers Gone, they were from Pete Seeger, their first hit, Lemon Tree, they were all done with these two guitars.
And the two guitars, the idea being that you'd have that sound of the nylon and the steel playing at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the way they recorded the album was they put them in front of two mics and recorded in stereo. So when you listen to them, you get like the one Peter and his voice and his steel string in one, and then you get Noel or Paul and the nylon string and his voice in the other. And then Mary stood in the middle and her voice kind of came through both sides.
Oh, that's incredible.
It's kind of a very cool sound. And the other thing, you know, we're talking about these bigger ideas earlier. So one of the things that this donation of these guitars does for the museum is that they were so involved in like the civil rights movement. They were so involved in like early like anti-war movement. You know, it's the idea that music can be used for social justice, for these broader, you know, rebellion or for protest. And it really brings in two objects that were used in that way. And it's kind of a cool other bigger story.
Which is what you're going for.
I mean, you're connecting these things to bigger ideas. Yeah.
Right. Oh, so this is where you're supposed to come in.
Right.
And it's a display and it's gorgeous. It's got a conch shell in the middle, which sort of represents sort of, I'm assuming, just like the first.
Right, very like early music.
Primeval sort of wind instrument.
Making music with whatever you find.
And right. then out of that starts, you start to branch out into all these historic pieces of brass and...
Yeah, they're all... This whole display is of brass instruments, and we call it fanfare. You know, you think about fanfares being played with, you know, trumpets and with brass
And also when
bands.
You enter, yeah.
And you're entering our galleries to this visual fanfare, but also representing musical fanfare. And the idea of the conch shell in the middle, yes, it's the found object, it's the origins of how people would have made music, and then emanating out sort of in circles around that, you have ideas based on instruments that are played for signaling, instruments that are based and used for ritual, for instruments that represent your status. And then kind of on the periphery of the whole thing, we have the instruments that we would think of for music making, you know, the things that you need to play chromatically to play in your orchestra or your band or in the opera pit.
Right, so it starts to sort of become further and further away from just that conch into the point where you start going into chromaticism, the ability to play in more than one key.
Right, right, and sort of modern music making.
Wow.
And the cool thing about this, it represents ideas that we're going to play on in the whole gallery. So, for example, we have ancient objects. Our oldest object in here is a pre-Columbian trumpet made out of clay that's sort of right here in the middle. And then we have very modern things. We have a plastic vuvuzela from the 2012 World Cup in Africa.
Yeah.
So you have sort of old, you have new. And like I said, ceramics and plastics, those aren't made of brass, but they're brass instruments because you're playing them the way you play a trumpet. You know, you're buzzing your lips into a cup. And that's what defines that instrument type.
Wow, it's beautiful. All right, and here we've taken, people should also know that this is right above the armory.
It's right above the arms and armor.
It's a really fun area of the Met.
Music and war.
Music and war.
So this, we're standing in the gallery. We call this music sort of through time. And we're looking at chronologically things, everything from ancient Egypt. We've got some instruments here on the wall, all the way down to sort of modern era electric things and new materials and stuff. But these two cases we're standing in front of, we just entered the gallery. These are the ones I was telling you about with the violin that was made for the French court and the marriage to Philip II of Spain. Yeah. And then the ivory, the pieces on the ivory back of the pipa.
Wow.
So this is the juxtaposition of those two ideas. 16th century objects. Both exquisite.
Yeah, absolutely. And the detail, especially on the pipa in particular. So these all these hexagons have some sort of religious meaning.
Yeah, or philosophical or life. They're symbols. So like at the top, there are the eight immortals from Buddhism.
Okay.
For example, and you get conch shells, you get all sorts of symbols of life, of longevity, of luck, all playing out as you go down on these little hexagonal plaques.
Right.
All hand carved. I mean, they're just simply exquisite.
Outstanding.
And they're laid out, that hexagon, that's an Islamic motif, that honeycombing pattern. So
that had made its way over. So that it was sort of cosmopolitan.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And of course, this is an instrument that guitarists. I mean, the pipa. It's a four string, plucked, instrument. So it's related in a way to the lute.
Very much.
And then to the guitar. Yeah.
Very much, and especially with our connection with the tar and the our connection to Persia and then their connection to the Middle East as
right,
well.
Exactly.
So it's sort of right there in the middle.
Right.
It's beautiful.
So right now we're standing in front of two very old Baroque guitars in the collection. They're hanging sort of in a little group with a couple of lutes. And then just exquisite, these are 17th century guitars, one from Venice and one from Paris. Just over the top decoration. So you'll see the one from Paris, we've got the back out because the back is covered with this wonderful red tortoise shell decoration. And the one from Venice has all this ivory and bone and ebony and
lattice,
exactly.
Yeah.
And there's what they call a wedding cake rose, it's parchment. That's sort of shaped like a wedding cake, and then set into the rose or the sound hole of the guitar. And it's just phenomenally beautiful. But these are 10-string gut-strung Baroque guitars. You know, this is the ancestor of our guitars now. But these were obviously the instruments of the wealthy, instruments of the upper classes. You know, were they ever even played? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they look very new, and like you're saying, that's a parchment inside of the rosette in the sound hole. There's this parchment sort of just display. It almost looks like a 3D printed situation. Like, I can't believe that a human hands did that.
No, it's fantastic.
And it's placed in there, and you guys have just, not you guys, but everybody has done a good job at maintaining this?
Well, it begs the question, were these instruments to be played, or were they art objects that you displayed?
Right.
You know, so was it like, oh yeah, make me a guitar to hang up in my, you know...
Interesting.
My whatever. All right. So, well, now we're standing in front of two of our more famous instruments, I guess you say, instruments. These are two violins by the great, famous Italian maker Antonio Stradivari. We know him often as Stradivarius, which was his Latinized version of his name. So he's making instruments in the way that they've made instruments in Cremona for 100 years. You know, Andrea Amati, we talked about him earlier.
Yeah, that was his predecessor.
Sets the form of the instrument. Stradivari is working about 100 and some years later. And we have two gorgeous examples here. One is from who's a very innovative and experimental builder. So he's constantly sort of changing little things and seeing how they work and changing them back and trying a new idea. And he really gets to the point where he's making instruments that like look like art. Like every little detail is exquisitely executed. And that's where sort of the art idea comes into great violins, as opposed to some of the earlier makers who are a little bit more like, just get the things what plays and give it to them. Yeah. So we have what's called a long pattern Strad here on the right, on the left. Sorry. And that was a model that he invented that's just a slightly bit longer than your typical violin. He figured out all the proportions so that it looks exactly the same. So it's like it's like, you know, you change like a centimeter on an instrument like a violin, like the proportions are going to be all off. But it's all done, you know, like by hand and by eye, and then he masterfully could change things up like this and you hardly notice it.
Well,
This is one of my favorite instruments.
This is the Ashanti drum, yeah.
This is one of my favorite instruments in the whole collection.
Why is that?
Well, so first of all, it's more modern than it seems. It's from 1940s. Mm-hmm. It was used in groups called N10 bands. Mm-hmm. They were sort of pop music bands in Ghana. And this is a breasted drum. It has two breasts on
it. You said 1940s?
1940s. Uh-huh. So it's a breasted drum. It has two breasts on it.
Right.
Representing mother.
They look a little like handles, right? They look like you would pick up the drum with it.
Yeah, probably not. There's screws on them and they screw in and out.
Okay, cool.
So, but they do have they're not your typical breast shapes. They're a little bit unusual.
Yeah.
But the reason why I love it is it's carved with all of these wonderful symbols all over the body. And these things, this was a community drum. I mean, a lot of the things we've looked at would have been used for social status, like the king owned it, or
right.
the oba had the trumpet or whatever. This was very much like for the community. These N10 bands would play for weddings, they'd play for community celebrations, you know, baptisms or coming of age ceremonies, if you will. And it's decorated with symbols that are important to the community. And most of them, I don't know what they mean, but they're connected to proverbs, to sayings, to values. But one of the very cool things is right in the middle of the breasts, you see that there's a heart.
Yeah.
And the heart represents the idea of the heart of a mother. It's patience. Right?
Patience.
Mother's heart is always patient. At least my mother's heart.
Yeah.
Below that, there's an elephant and palm trees. And these are symbols of strength. So think of this like a pictogram. So it's those together are patience and strength. And then on either side of the breasts, look what's there. What do you see?
Animals.
What's the animal, though? What specifically?
A lion
and
a crown.
A lion and a crown.
Right.
You know what that's a symbol of?
Royalty.
The king. English king.
English king.
The lion. Yeah. And remember, Ghana is a colonial society.
Yeah.
So you've got a lion and a crown. That's the English lion. You've got one of those on either side of the breasts. Now, in a lot of these drums, you find a lion and a crown in the middle of the breasts, or you might see a Union Jack flag there.
Huh.
But here, they push them to the side. And remember, let's think of this as a pictogram.
Right.
You've got your heart, patience, right. Elephant palm tree, strength. With patience and strength, we'll push the British out.
Oh, so this was revolution.
This was an anti-colonial message. And if you have any doubts about that, I'm going to show you one other symbol on this drum.
Okay.
I'm going to walk around here.
Sure.
And you see this wonderful looking vehicle carved on the side of the drum?
Yeah, there's a little rat driving
a model car.
Model T. Model,
something, that sort of thing, yeah. Well, who had cars in colonial Ghana?
The English.
And who's driving that car?
It's a dirty rat.
They're calling the British rats.
Right to their face.
Right to their face. Right on this drum that would have sat in the middle of these ensembles.
Wow.
And probably completely unnoticed.
Yeah, I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, it has tons of meaning that we'll probably never understand.
Well, I think cats, scholars have...
Yeah, they know.
Figured this all out. I don't have all of it.
But there's a cat, and then he's got a little pine... There's all sorts of weird things.
Yeah, and if I had my notes here, I could tell you what they all mean, but these are the narratives that we like to pick.
There's a guy just having a brewski at a table.
I hope so. I hope that's a brewski.
Great. I mean, the Peter, Paul, and Mary, I can understand why that was so attractive, because what attracts me anytime to something like this, or like a guest on an interview or whatever, or a piece that I'm playing or something, is when it really serves all these different functions. And the Peter, Paul, and Mary guitars are wonderful because they talk about something that's happening technically aurally.
Yeah.
When you're talking about something being in a left and right channel and that sound coming from the mixture of the steel and the nylon at the same time, creating this sound that's been replicated over and over again by folk musicians for the last 50 years.
Absolutely.
Implications on the future and the past.
Yeah. I think you just explained the favorites. Like it's mm-hmm. the objects that offer you multiple great stories and ideas. So it's like, are they a great work of art? Are they a great musical instrument? Was there an amazing story about how it was used, about how who made it, about who played it? You know, those are the stories that, like, it's like, what's the line from Shrek? Like, it's like an onion with layers.
Yeah.
Those are the best objects, the onions. You go to YouTube, you'll see all these videos, especially of classical guitars. In fact, we have a whole bunch of our guitars played, not the Segovia ones, of course, because mm-hmm. of the rule, but we have an amazing, Ramirez 3 that Christopher Parkening owned, mm-hmm. and we have that recorded. We have a Hauser guitar on loan from the Augustine Foundation that was played by Jorge Caballera mm-hmm. online. We have a beautiful Flauta guitar that's been played by a number of people. So we try to do when we can and when the objects are up to it, keep these things functioning in the way they were originally meant to be. It's rare. I mean, we can't play everything. A lot of these things are way too fragile or too old, but the things that we can, it's a part of the story. It's a part of what we do.
You know, about this museum, because there's so many things in this museum that you can see that you would go, is that just an object? Is that just a tool? Or is that an art? Or at what point does the tool become art?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways I would argue that this is a little bit like a conversation we had earlier about the lines between high and low getting erased now. I think that there is is this art is a question I think used to be asked here about everything, like what's the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and now I think it's becoming less important that way because art itself is questioned. Artists today, what's performance art, what's a vacuum cleaner in a corner of a gallery, what is art is almost a moot question. Mm-hmm. It's like, what speaks to you? What speaks to me as a curator who acts as a bit of a gatekeeper to getting something into the collection? Mm-hmm. And then what are the narratives? What are the stories? What's the reasons it's here? And I think that the what is art question is almost, I wouldn't say it's moot, because things have to be good and important and cool to come into the Met collection.
Right.
We've got very little storage space and our galleries are packed.
Yeah, but we're just having other discussions.
Yeah, but from a philosophical point.
Yeah.
Think about composers. You know, what is music?
Yeah.
I mean, you could probably do a 10 podcasts about that question and never get to an answer that everybody agrees on.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some ways even as a musical instrument curator, is a bell a musical instrument? I say yes. Is a car horn a musical instrument? Of course. I have a very broad church sort of definition. Like, if it's created to make sound,
Yeah.
It's an instrument. Some things that aren't created to make sound, but people use that way, right, are also instruments. Well, you know what? I have a little surprise here for you.
What?
Well, I was thinking that, you know, you are a guitarist, right?
I am a guitarist.
There you go. So we have a beautiful 1953 Ignazio Fleta guitar that we use quite regularly, and I thought maybe you might have some fun playing it today.
I would. You know, I used to have a couple of Fletas, but I pawned them for rent. So this will be nice.
No, we can't pawn this one, but let's give it a whirl.
Okay, let me take off all the buttons. Jason, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it as an artist, as a guitarist, and as a New Yorker. One of the dreams of anybody moving to New York is to come to this museum. And I've spent so much time here. Back in the day, I used to live on 89th and 2nd, and I would come here every Sunday for many years. And it was just a beautiful thing to just, even if it was just to go look at the blue bed.
Yeah.
But now all these guitars come into the GFA, and anybody in the future, anybody listening to this, can come and see this magnificent collection.
No, I've had a great time too. I've loved getting to show you around the collection and talk about these things. And yes, I mean, really, every guitarist coming to GFA or whenever he gets to town, please do come see these guitars. They're part of our history.
They are. Thank you so much, Jason. That does it for my time with Jason. I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. It was a highlight for me, as far as the show is concerned. I love doing it. It was my first interview in person. I forgot to tell you guys that. Since the beginning of COVID, I used to do these in person all the time now. And, that was an adjustment, but boy, was it fun. It was great. I went to the old neighborhood. I was doing it in person again. I was in the old museum that I love, and I was talking to a great guy, so it was a lot of fun. Thank you to him for coming on. Make sure that you visit the museum when you are here for the GFA, the Guitar Foundation of America's competition and festival, right? Which is taking place later this month, I believe. I think. I don't know. I'm going to be out of town for it. So my mind is just flooded with my own guitar stuff, babies, and camp. School year's over. Anyway, also make sure that you support Nicholas and all the Austinites over there and their amazing Austin-ness. by going and seeing Serenade I Miss You on YouTube. Check it out. Serenade I Miss You on YouTube. It'll be available in recorded form later this year. That's Nicholas Hurt, Serenade I Miss You. And support the show. You can also talk about your projects like Nicholas did. He's supporting the show. And if you have anything that you want us to share, I'd be happy to do it. That's not that expensive. If you want something a little more involved, like what Nicholas and I did, it ends up being more because it's sort of a pain in the butt. But it's never a pain in the butt to do something as long as it's good. That's the other thing. I don't really put things in the front. Remember when I sold mattresses? All right, I'll see you guys next time. We're going to have the founders of the Brooklyn Classical Guitarist Society. That's right. There's two societies. We got two baseball teams, two hockey teams, two basketball teams. We got it. And now we got two guitar societies. All right? New York, New York. Very New York episode. And with a little bit of Austin sprinkled in. I'll see you guys then. Very excited to talk to these guys about the new society.